Continue. Okay.
Okay, well, good evening, everybody, in this wet weather. I'm Guy Brandenburg. I'm the current president of National Capital Astronomers, and I'm opening this up for a talk by Dr. Kevin Stevenson, who's going to be talking about rocky exoplanets and other exoplanets and other stuff like that. I'm very much looking forward to this. I'm quite intrigued by the prospect of maybe someday finding a rocky exoplanet with life on it. I want to give a couple of announcements about things that are coming up. Our next National Capital Astronomers meeting is on May 10th. That's a Saturday. Week before that, May 3rd, is Exploring the Sky, and we could definitely use volunteers to come out with telescopes. Who knows if it'll be clear? Last time was not clear, and that was earlier. What was that? Last week? Yeah, it was last week. And at least one group of people did come, even though we had canceled it. And I've talked to the rangers, and they said that they will in the future put up a sign on the inside of the door of the Nature Center and let people know.
What's the appendix?
May 3rd, it's in, you can see on the webpage, capitalastronomers.org, if you didn't know. Some people in Tacoma Park have asked for some telescopes on Saturday, April 26th. I said I would go, and some other people would be nice too. An interesting thing that Gail Gomez, Gail, raise your hand. Okay. He's been doing sidewalk astronomy, and I've been helping too, along with Zach Lieberman in various places, including Mount Pleasant. And some people from the Smithsonian happened to come across him doing that and entertaining his neighbors tremendously. And I've been helping too. It's really a lot of fun. And so they said, well, this year we're doing the Folklife Festival on the subject of youth and the future. And so they have a young person, 18, right? Doing sidewalk astronomy with a homemade telescope and learning all kinds of stuff. He's way better astrophotography for than myself. And so we're scheduled for a couple of three sessions, one in the day, two at night, or something like that. During the Folklife Festival, July 2nd through the 7th. The exact dates are still to be determined. So that's the announcements I have for coming up stuff. Does anybody have any other announcements of things? Yes.
Rocket science thing.
Oh, good. What day is that?
I think it's it's tomorrow.
So it's a Sunday, right?
27th, I think. That's right. Right. I don't know if the joint time is today. I believe it is on Sunday.
Sunday. Okay, good.
I
That
think.
right.
Always have Sunday. Yeah, but is that rocket science? Yeah.
Okay, great. Thanks for mentioning that.
And I understand that you will have a NCA solar telescope there. There are usually several other telescopes from organizations such as NOVAC. But also be sure to come inside and see all the exhibits and demos and things inside.
Right. It's kind of a fun day and it's free.
At Montgomery College in Rockville.
Right. Okay. Oh, one another announcement. We have nominations for various officers coming up. That's because we have elections every year. And we have a president, vice president, secretary, treasurer, assistant secretary, treasurer, and trustee. So the trustees' positions rotate their 4-year term. You're in which year of your term? Do you remember? You're still a trustee, right? Not you. In the back. You're not a trustee anymore?
Never.
I thought you were. Okay, never mind. All right. Okay, so I've agreed to run for president again. We still need a vice president. Vice president is a very important job. It's the person who goes out and looks for new speakers. Jim Simpson, raise your hand. Okay. And he's been our secretary treasurer for a couple of years now, and he's doing a great job. And he's agreed to continue. Don't anybody discourage him.
He
And
wants to think that.
but if you do that, make sure you run for it. We got a nominee for somebody who has agreed, Brian Tomich, for assistant secretary treasurer. And Zachary Gleiberman has agreed to be run for a trustee for whichever position is running out. So we really need a vice president. And can you tell us a little bit about what it requires?
Well, just have to keep your eyes and ears open for scientific talks in the area, preferably local talks. People can come here in person and speak. And we just need to make sure that you give them all the information they need for what we're expecting. I must say it's quite gratifying when a speaker like tonight's speaker is no exception. When you see them speak someplace and you go up to them and you say, "Well, it'd be nice if you would speak to the National Capital of Astronomers," and when they say yes, it's quite nice. It's a rewarding job in that sense.
Okay.
Maybe I can make a suggestion.
Yes.
Each time you invite a speaker, ask them to recommend two people. And
Okay.
I've already recommended a couple of people. One person gave a talk 2 months ago,
I was
and
going to mention
yeah. And then you'll just build and build and build your list. And it's,
Okay.
yeah.
Great.
Yeah, thanks for doing that.
And another thing, we recently had a couple of science fair exhibit that we went to. And Veronica, did or Isaiah, did you want to say anything about the PG County Fair? Little louder. Did everybody hear that? Because I'd one more time.
We could not hear it online, that's for sure.
There was a lot of nice stuff there, a lot of nice stuff that people made, like a lot of good stuff to see that people can make and think
I think just from my own experience having been there, I saw a lot of creativity, a lot of innovation that I think these young people are just very unique with. And one of the things that stood out to me was the young girl who created a solar panel tracker. Yes, a solar panel tracker, which basically, I don't want to spill too much, but it basically maneuvers itself to find the best amount of sunlight to generate power for the solar panels. And so she created her own code, and just seeing everything from beginning to end was just very rewarding to see. We got a chance to be the award judges and see other creative young kids with their other projects. And so I think I would definitely love to go back. And that also leads me to my son, who says that now he wants to launch his own project to identify habitable planets now that he's learned all about Chitra. And so it, just being there just was, it was rewarding just to be in that space with all these creative young people. So yeah, thanks.
Yeah, I also went to the one in Fairfax County, and those were even better than the ones in PG.
Oh,
The
wow.
one in DC is still recovering. They're, the people in charge not well organized, and the projects weren't very good. And some other people. It was Jay Miller. Are you here today, Jay? Okay. And Gil Funk, who went to the one in Montgomery County. And from that, I think we have either three or four speakers. So we're going to have a lot of speakers on our June meeting. Our elections are next month, and the meeting on in June will be speakers from these science fairs. One of them will have to speak in May because she's got a summer camp that she's going off to. Anybody else have any other announcements? Oh, did you want to say anything about?
I just want to make sure we capture all the names and addresses of people who are getting awards from us, because I need to get magazines off to us.
Right. I've got to get you that too. Right. Gal, did you want to say anything?
Well, last week we did some cyber astronomy on Friday. Was it? No, it was Tuesday. We did some cyber astronomy in the corner in Mount Pleasant Street. We had three telescopes. Mr. Brandenburg and Zach went out with their, I think it was a AT-72 refractor on this Altaz mount that Mr. Brandenburg has. And I had this 10-inch Mercalli grain, also on an Altaz mount, that was funnily enough actually found at the Chevy Chase Community Center. Just sitting there, I managed to make it work. And then I also had my energy dog. And we got some like maybe 100, 120, 30 people over the course of the night. It was a lot of fun. Cyber astronomy in there is, it's always great. You always get a
it
fun.
Really is great. People are so happy to look through a telescope and see planets and stars and so on. For many of them, it's their first time. And it's now possible, even with a DOB, a completely unguided DOB, to find just about any target you want. You know, within limits, you're not going to see the real dim stuff, but you can at least find it, even, well, as long as there's some stars that you can see. Okay.
I have an announcement.
Go ahead.
So we do have Maryland Day coming up on Saturday, April 26th. It's the usual where it will be set up in front of the Department of Astronomy will be set up in front of the old engineering building in the tents. If the weather allows, we'll have some solar telescopes set up. But yeah, Maryland Day, Saturday, April 26th.
Okay. Okay, so I should probably entertain a nomination. I don't think I can do it, but Guy Brandenburg for president, James Simpson for secretary treasurer, Brian Tomich for assistant secretary treasurer, and Zachary Gleiberman for trustee. Does anybody else want to make another nomination right here? Okay. Does anybody want to make a motion that we accept those nominees? Somebody raise their hand. Okay. All right. Is there a second to that motion? Okay, good. Any discussion? Okay. All in favor, raise your hand. Okay. Hands down. All opposed? Okay, good. But we still need vice president. All right, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Hey, Guy, you might want to clarify, that's just a proposed slate that people can still volunteer to run and everything.
Thank you. That is absolutely correct.
Okay, one really quick thing, I looked it up and can verify that Rockville Science Day is indeed Sunday, April 27th.
Okay.
Noon to 5 p.m.
Okay, great. Okay, so Carl.
Good evening, everyone. I just wanted to run through a little bit of our schedule and introduce our speaker tonight. Now, in February, we had Matt Clement from the Applied Physics Lab, APL, speak about the theory and simulations of planetary systems. Last month, we had Heidi Hamill, who spoke to us about using JWST in particular to explore our solar system and the outer planets in particular. Next month, we'll hear from Rob Zellum on the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. And of course, one of the primary science objectives of Roman is to do a census of exoplanets and all the science that accompanies them. And then in September, we have Kristin Sotsen, also from, is that how you pronounce your name?
Sotsen, Kristin Sotsen.
Sotsen.
Yep.
Also from APL. I have to say, even though we're on the hallowed ground of University of Maryland, that APL, the Applied Physics Lab, has really become a hotbed of planetary research and exoplanet science, as exemplified by tonight's speaker and these other two that that Kevin has recommended. So tonight's speaker is Dr. Kevin Stevenson from APL, who will continue with this ongoing theme we have of contemporary planetary science. Kevin is an exoplanet astronomer who works at the intersection of planetary sciences, astrophysics, and heliophysics. He's the principal investigator for the MDWARF opportunity, is that what it's called?
That's right.
Which is part of the Interdisciplinary Consortia for Astrobiology Research, ICAR, and is also, was a PI on a large James Webb Space Telescope Cycle 1 GO program, General Observer Program, and I guess you have other data from subsequent cycles.
You got it.
The title of Kevin's talk tonight is Strange New Worlds.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And thank you all for coming. I also want to give you a brief introduction about myself, sort of both in and outside of academia. I went to grad school at University of Central Florida. Back then, astronomy wasn't a big thing. Exoplanets wasn't a big thing. It was just starting out. It was 2007. And we were using a small space telescope called Spitzer that was built and designed for astrophysics, but not exoplanets. And we used that telescope to measure the first light that came from exoplanets. And we discovered new exoplanets. Sort of my claim to fame there in grad school was discovering a sub-Earth size rocky exoplanet candidate, UCF 1.01. From there, I went to University of Chicago as a NASA Sagan Fellow, where I used the Hubble Space Telescope primarily, and I performed the first spectroscopic phase curve of an exoplanet. From there, I moved to the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore. I worked with software development for the James Webb Space Telescope before it launched. And then most recently, about 5 years ago, I moved to Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab, where I'm now, as you said, the principal investigator of an ICAR called CHAMPS, Consortium for Habitability and Atmospheres of MDWARF Planets. Also, some fun things about me. My favorite candy are Skittles. My favorite sport is hockey. Unfortunately, my... Oh, geez, we are a little bit off. We'll survive. It's okay. Hold on. Nope. Okay. We're off a little, but we'll live. Don't worry about it. Okay, move on. My favorite sport is hockey. And my favorite pet, this is Duke. He's a 14-year-old. He's a bit of a senior citizen these days, but he's fantastic. And he's actually going to be our guide today as we travel through to answer the question of, are we alone? So, this is our pyramid of knowledge that we hope to climb with the assistance of our fateful guide, Duke. For millennia, we've actually been asking the question of, are we alone? And we haven't actually been able to make a lot of progress until just recently. Actually, I was looking at this magazine, Sky and Telescope. I just picked one up randomly. And inside of it, this is from 1941, by the way, inside of it says, is Mars inhabited, right? Is Mars inhabited? Right there. And there's a whole article and discussion about it. So yes, we've been asking this questions about life outside of our own sphere for a long, long time. And we haven't been able to make any progress on that. We've been sort of stuck at this base level for generations. And then just recently in the 2010s, we finally been able to make that step. We found the first rocky exoplanets. Okay. And that was a huge step forward, because once you start finding them, then you can start studying their atmospheres. When you start looking at their atmospheres, you figure out their compositions. And then, of course, you can take the next step and start searching for life. So this is where we had to get to. The 2010s are in the past. Studying their atmospheres, that's right now, the James Webb Space Telescope in the 2020s. And then the search for life in the 2030s and beyond. And I'll talk about that at the end. But let's start right now with part one, finding rocky exoplanets. So imagine, if you will, tonight after the talk, you're driving home and you come up to a dark intersection, and here we have an oncoming car with its bright lights, right? Now, of course, you can't really see anything left or right, but you think you hear something. What could it be? Well, it's a truck. You don't see the truck, but you see the silhouette of the truck as it passes in front. And then you see a cyclist too, same thing. You didn't actually see the truck or the cyclist, but what you did see is evidence that suggests that they were there based off of the dimming of light. And that's what we call a light curve. It's pretty simple. It's just brightness on one axis, like the y-axis, and time on the x-axis. And as we measure the light as a function of time, the brightness, we can see that it dims as the vehicle crosses in front. And then it also dims when the cyclist passes in front, but not quite as much. And what that tells us is the relative size of the cyclist versus the vehicle, okay, by the deepness of that of the transit depth here. So the same concept applies for exoplanets here. When we're trying to find transiting exoplanets, we don't actually distinguish the planet from the star. It's together. But what we can do is we look at this Jupiter-sized planet, which is just hidden down here, maybe difficult to see. And as it crosses in front of the star, it dips down significantly. Okay. Now, this is an example of a Jupiter-sized planet around a sun-like star. We can do the same process for a rocky planet around a sun-like star. And you notice that it's not as deep, right? There's a difference here. And how much is that difference? Well, the first transit, the rocky or the Jupiter-sized planet, has a depth of about 1%. And that's not too bad. That's not something we could see with our eyes, but that's enough that we can see with traditional CCD detectors. So if I were to give you an example of what 1% looks like, this is actually a good pointing stick right here. This is about a meter in height, right? 1% is about that much, right? It's like the thickness of your cell phone. So if imagine this was the brightness of your star, it would dim by about that much in order to detect the Jupiter-sized planet. Now, if you do this for a rocky exoplanet, the transit depth is 0.01%. That's maybe the thickness of this piece of paper right here. That's the transit depth that you're looking for. This is why it's really hard to detect these rocky exoplanets around sun-like stars, is the signal size is just so small. So we play a little trick. This is one of two equations I'm showing you tonight. It's a simple equation. The transit depth is just a function of the planet area on top and the stellar area on the denominator. And so, you know, with sun-like stars, 0.01%, that's difficult. We can't really change the size of the planet, right? A rocky planet like the Earth is the size that it is. So we can't change anything about the numbers on top, but we can change something about the numbers down below, the stellar area. Instead of looking at a sun-like star, let's look at smaller, cooler M dwarfs. Now, if we do that, all of a sudden this transit depth increases to 0.1%. That's hard, yes, but it's still doable. I'm showing you an example here. This is the sun in the top right-hand corner to scale versus TRAPPIST-1, which is one of the smallest known stars. It's about the size of Jupiter, actually. So this M-Dwarf Opportunity is how we go about finding and characterizing these rocky exoplanets. Okay, so let's actually take a look at some real data here. This is an observation that was made back in August of 2022. This is a real light curve from a real exoplanet with the James Webb Space Telescope. It's called LHS 475b. And here's what the data look like. This was actually JWST's first exoplanet discovery. You may have heard the announcement about it in 2023. It was all over the news, and this JWST found a planet. This is the one right here. And you'll notice the relative brightness here. It only goes down by about 0.1%. But look at the quality of the data, right? This is incredible. We can fit the light curve with our models and determine the size of the planet to be 99% the diameter of the Earth. That is phenomenal. Yes.
Does the inclination of the orbit have any effect on
the inclination of the orbit will change the shape of the transit. It'll change sort of the duration, but it doesn't change the depth. So we can infer something about the inclination of the orbit just by knowing the period of the planet and from that the semi-major axis and then the inclination.
Relatively fewer data points during the dip, the drop, and the rise indicate how fast it orbits.
So the question was about the number of data points during the drop, which is ingress, and the rise, which is egress. It indicates partly the orbital period, partly the distance the planet is from the star, and partly the inclination. It's not a one-to-one correlation. So that the shape of this right here, the ingress, is determined by where the planet crosses the star and its period. So if the planet is lower down relative to the star, that ingress is going to be longer, and it'll be more V-shaped.
The difference in between the highest and the lowest points from JWST, just normally without, just like generally.
Yep.
I'm guessing that's caused by just general inconsistencies on the data by sensor noise or just dust in the solar system and whatnot.
Yes, so that's a good point. There's a general trend from the beginning to the end of the observation, a bit of a slope, if you will, right? That could be caused by variability from the star, but in this case, and in fact, most cases, it's usually caused by instrument systematics, right? The telescope electronics aren't perfectly stable, and they'll have some variation in temperature throughout the evening. It's always evening there. that does cause, you know, the measured flux to change. Yeah, absolutely. And this is a very easy trend to model. It gets much more sophisticated, and I won't show you those ones, but that's basically my job most of the day is to fit out systematics. Okay, so now we know that JWST can find these rocky exoplanets, which is great. But actually, it's not meant to do that. JWST has this very small field of view. It only points at one small part of this patch of the sky. What we need are large fields of view, missions like TESS and Kepler in the past, and they've gone out and found thousands of exoplanets, of which over 1,300 of them are terrestrial in nature. This means that any one of those 1,300 are have the opportunity to be studied to see if they have atmospheres, to see if they potentially are habitable. Now, we have to focus a little bit on the M-dwarfs because these ones are the best targets for our searches, for our understanding of these rocky exoplanets. And fortunately, M-dwarfs are very common. About 3/4 of the stars in our local neighborhood are M-dwarfs, so that's great. And also, rocky planets are very common around M-dwarf stars. Remember, these M-dwarfs are smaller and cooler, and so if you want to study the planets in the habitable zone, these planets are also going to be closer into their stars where they have short orbital periods and they have a higher transit probability. In short, everything is looking up for these rocky planets around the M dwarfs. Everything is going for them. They've got everything they need. We just need to detect their atmospheres and study them. There are 187 terrestrial exoplanets around M dwarfs. About a dozen of them are in the habitable zone. So we are good to go. And Duke is very happy about that. He has found his mountain of planets. He is excited. We've done, you know, our decade or more of transit exoplanet discovery. And we need to move on to the next stage, right? This is where we're at now. We want to study their atmospheres. And James Webb Space Telescope is what's enabling us to do that. So let's move on to part two, studying their atmospheres. Before I get into that, we have to talk a little bit about spectroscopy. Now, does anyone recognize that image on the right there? Yes. Okay. What's it from? Shout it out. Pink Floyd. Exactly. Right? This is how everyone learns spectroscopy. Pink Floyd. It's a prism, right? We have white light coming in, maybe sunlight, maybe starlight. It goes through the prism and gets broken up into different wavelengths, right? I'm not going to go to it into detail here. I'm sure other speakers have done that as well. I know Heidi did last week. But just so that everyone's on board with the sort of the terminology that I'm going to be using, visible light obviously covers from, you know, the violet all the way out to red, shorter wavelengths, ultraviolet. That's the terminology I'll use, shorter wavelengths. And then longer wavelengths are out beyond the red. So if I talk about infrared wavelengths, that is basically off the screen, way over that way. That's what the James Webb Space Telescope uses. So we will not be focusing in on optical. We'll be shifted off to the right, looking at infrared wavelength. That's where basically bodies emit light because they are warm. They emit at infrared wavelengths. The most important thing to understand about spectroscopy is these absorption lines here. So this is a spectrum, I think, of the sun. And you can see the brightness is a function of wavelength. We use a lot of different terms for brightness, by the way. Here's, you know, intensity, counts, flux, power, absorbance, transmittance. There's a lot of terminology there, but it's really just photons, light, brightness, okay? What happens is when you have molecules or atoms that are, you know, part of the sun, for example, hydrogen, they like to absorb light at certain wavelengths. And you can see that here with these absorption features, hydrogen, three of them. And each atom or each molecule has its own spectral fingerprint. So it'll look a little bit different for each one. This is the fingerprints for sodium, nitrogen, hydrogen, and oxygen. So you can see, don't worry about too much about absorption versus emission, but you can see that patterns look different for each one of them. And this is what enables us to identify one molecule from another inside an exoplanet atmosphere. So how does this work in reality? Remember, we have the star and we have the planet transiting in front of it. And if there is, for example, water in the atmosphere of this planet, then it will appear larger at those wavelengths where water absorbs light. And at other wavelengths where water doesn't absorb, the planet will appear smaller. So our spectrum of the planet essentially is just measuring different depths as a function of wavelength. And by taking that information and plotting it up, we can figure out which molecular species are absorbing in the atmosphere and which ones are not. Okay, so with all that in mind, let's take a look at an actual spectrum of an actual planet. Here we go. This is a transmission spectrum right here. And you can I have various molecules listed, carbon dioxide, nitrogen, methane, ozone, water, what have you. Does anyone know what planet this is? Not Mars. Nope, good try. A little closer.
Venus?
Not Venus either. Go back the other way. Take the difference between the two. That's us. This is a transmission spectrum made by SciSat, an actual satellite orbiting the Earth. Isn't that incredible? We can measure the transmission spectrum of the Earth, and we can identify all of these species here. We can see the biosignature, bioindicators, and also techno signatures. I'm going to point something out to you right here. You may have not seen this. CFC 11 and 12. Chlorofluorocarbon.
Freon.
Yeah, freon. There you go. CFCs in our own atmosphere. These are signs of technology, right? Of pollution in our atmosphere. They were banned back in 1987 with the Montreal Protocol. And yet they still exist in our atmosphere today. And some people are actually looking for CFCs in exoplanets as a form of a technosignature to find life, to find intelligent life that's polluting their atmospheres. Yeah. I think we're learning our lesson. We have decreased the amount of CFCs in our atmosphere since 87. But who knows? Not everyone takes those steps. And so this is really cool. This is a goal that we wish to have for our exoplanets that we are studying GWST. The precision isn't quite as good, but we use this as a template for our own understanding. And we looked at these molecules and said, you know what? Here's a giant carbon dioxide feature, 4.3 microns. It should be really easy to see in exoplanets. So why don't we go after that molecule right there and see if we can find it? Yeah.
Speaking of the aftereffects of the CFCs, we detected the aftereffects of the error of leaded gasoline.
That's a good question. Have we detected the effects of leaded gasoline in the atmosphere? I would say probably yes. I don't know what the lifetime is in the atmosphere, the sort of thing that the half-life. If it's relatively short, then it may have dissipated. But that's a good question. I don't. Probably. Okay. So we've done enough introductory material here. Let's get into some actual science. Big picture questions for rocky exoplanets. The first one, does the planet have an atmosphere? That is actually a very fundamental, important question to ask, because if it doesn't have an atmosphere, there's no point in continuing on looking for life. What is the nature of the atmosphere? What could it be composed of? Is it nitrogen dominated? Is it carbon dioxide dominated? Who knows? Once we know that, we can ask the question, is the planet habitable? And does the planet have signs of life? So I will try to get us through all of these questions in the remaining 20 minutes that I have, starting with the first one. Does the planet have an atmosphere? This is the most basic fundamental question that we are asking ourselves today, because we actually haven't found an exoplanet yet that we are confident, 100% confident, has an atmosphere. So let me talk about two programs that I've been involved in. Myself and Jake Lustig-Jaeger, we are co-PIs on a Cycle 1 program that was awarded 75 hours to look at 5 rocky exoplanets to answer that exact question. Do these planets have atmospheres? And then just a few weeks ago, we were awarded additional 245 hours of telescope time. That's the largest exoplanet program to date. To be able to answer that question for an additional 6 planets. And I'll be talking a little bit about those 6 planets and the motivation around this new program that over the next year and a half, I hope you'll hear lots about, and I hope we make lots of exciting discoveries. Okay, but to get there, we have to talk about the cosmic shoreline, which sounds really cool. Trust me, it is really cool. But the plot I'm about to show you is the least cool thing I've ever seen in my life. Sorry, Kevin Zonlay. this is the, let me describe the axes here. So the x-axis on the bottom is basically how well an atmosphere can be retained. So if a planet is over on the right-hand side, it's more likely to have an atmosphere. And on the left side axis here, the y-axis, the likelihood that the atmosphere gets stripped away. And so again, you don't want to be up high, you want to be down low. So essentially what you really want to be in this diagram, I'm going to show you a bunch of planets in the diagram. You want to be in the bottom right-hand corner because you're more likely to have an atmosphere. And then don't want to be in the top left-hand corner because you're less likely to have atmosphere. All right, here it is. This plot takes all of the major bodies in our own solar system and hundreds of known exoplanets and throws it all against this wall here and tries to tell us something important. There's this dividing line in black that I've highlighted. And all of the solar system bodies, right? We've got our planets here. We've got a couple of moons. Everything on the lower right side of that black line has an atmosphere in our own solar system. And everything above doesn't. So that's a really cool, important piece of information. Now, this applies to our own solar system. And so the idea that Zanlay and Catling had is that this could this apply to all of the other planets, all of the other systems out there? Is it a cosmic shoreline, not just a solar system shoreline? Yeah. Mercury is on the plot. Yeah, there's Mars here. Mercury should be right there. There you go. Yes. I'm more familiar with this version. I could just point Mercury right here, right there. So we cleaned up this plot a little bit just so I can step you through what our goals are. So this is the cosmic shoreline for our own sun, which is a G2 type star. And I've included our four rocky exoplanets here. And you can see these blue circles right here. This sort of indicates the population density of known exoplanets. And it seems very convenient that this population should sort of straddle the cosmic shoreline. It provides us a real exciting test bed to just figure out which planets have atmospheres and which ones don't. We can test the cosmic shoreline hypothesis just by looking at these exoplanets. The challenge we have is that we don't think the cosmic shoreline for a sun-like star is the same for other M-dwarf stars. We think it changes. And there's a lot of reason behind that that I don't have time to get into, but I'll give you an example here. So there are two systems that I added in, L9859 in yellow and LTT1445 also in yellow. We think that the cosmic shoreline actually for these M2 stars, which are early type M-dwarfs, is more indicative of this dashed line. And so there have been previous observations of the L9859 system. I will actually show you some spectra of that soon. But our idea is that we wanted to test this hypothesis. So we picked a system that we knew had two planets in it that straddled that new early M-dwarf shoreline, that LTT1445 AC, which is above, and AB, which is below. So if we're right, if we think the shoreline is this dashed line here for this particular type, one of these planets will have an atmosphere and one won't. And then we repeat that experiment for other systems, other stellar types. If it's a mid-type M-dwarf, it's going to be a little bit smaller, a little bit cooler. We picked two other systems, each with two planets in it, and to test the hypothesis. Where is the shoreline? Are both planets going to have an atmosphere? Is one of them going to have an atmosphere? Or maybe none of them will have an atmosphere. So we'll be able to repeat ourselves for these three systems, six planets in total. And the hope is that we will have the precision needed to determine whether or not they have atmospheres. And if they do, their compositions. And I'm going to point out LHS 1140 is the best target to observe in the Havilah zone. And we'll be getting, I think, six transits of that particular system in the next year and a half. There's also another system that you may have heard of, TRAPPIST-1. This is the smallest of the M-dwarfs, a late M-dwarf. And all of these planets here, there's seven rocky exoplanets in this TRAPPIST-1 system. All of them have been studied up to this date. I'm actually involved in programs with TRAPPIST-1E and TRAPPIST-1H. I will not be talking too much about that, but suffice to say that between all of these targets that have been observed, we hope to be able to answer the question of, is there a cosmic shoreline?
Nice.
Yeah.
Escape velocity, large escape velocity means it's more likely to retain the atmosphere.
Yes. So escape velocity means the speed that you need to obtain in order to escape the gravity from the planet. Okay, so if you have a higher escape velocity, a molecule, let's say water, is less likely to just fly off randomly. Think of it like gravity, basically, right?
That mean they're more massive?
They're more massive. That's absolutely right. Yeah. Yes. More massive planets tend to have higher escape velocities. Absolutely.
And from the y-axis, incident flux, that's from their local star?
That is exactly right. Incident flux from their star. Effectively, it's difficult to see because it's been cut off here, but essentially the temperature of the planet. That's the easiest way I can put it.
Okay.
So hotter planets are higher up on this plot. Yeah.
How much this is to be shifted due to observation bias?
There is an observation bias in terms of the planets that have been discovered. So this sort of distribution of planets right here are easy to find, where the planets down here are much more difficult to find. And so there is a bias in terms of finding these planets, but not necessarily a bias in terms of characterizing them. Yeah.
One other question. This is bias by the age of the system. And of course, tend to be older stars.
Yeah.
I think they have more time to strip atoms.
Oh, you've opened Pandora's box. okay, I will answer this question because I think it's a fascinating topic. And there have been a couple of papers that came out just in the past couple of months about this whole idea. The reason why we think that the cosmic shoreline shifts for different M dwarfs is because of how long, let me see, not their age, but how long M dwarfs spend in a state of fast rotation. So take an M8 star like TRAPPIST-1. It's predicted to be spinning at about 3.5 days. Every 3.5 days, it makes one rotation, right? And it's very active at this high rotation rate. Eventually, after a few billion years, it will slow down to something like a rotation rate of 100 days. But when it's rotating quickly, it's very active. It's creating a lot of havoc in the system. And the planets orbiting that star are experiencing huge amounts of flares, which then basically destroy the atmosphere.
Not necessarily age, but it's age related.
It's age related. Very good. Yes. And so the earlier M dwarf stars tend to what they call spin down sooner than the later M dwarfs. And so we think that we're going to have this shift because of that effect. And we'll find out. Any other questions? Okay, this is great. Let's move on to the next question. What is the nature of their atmospheres? So this is where we actually get to spend some time looking at real GWST data. I'm going to show you the transmission spectra of as many planets as I have time for. We'll start with a rocky super Earth called GJ46b. The right side is cut off, so I'll tell you the information that's on the right-hand side there. I had little indicators to show the size of the planet and the temperature. So this planet, GJ46b, is 1.3 times the size of the Earth. So it's more of a super Earth than an actual Earth. And it's about 700 Kelvin, which means 800 degrees Fahrenheit. Very, very hot. Hot enough for molten tin and probably molten lead. This is a planet that we observed as part of our Cycle 1 program. And this is the transmission spectrum here, these data points. So this is transit depth as a function of wavelength. And we're observing at infrared wavelengths from 3 to 5 microns. These vertical lines indicate error bars, or uncertainty. And it one thing is for certain, it doesn't look like the Earth spectrum that I showed you guys earlier, right? It's much lower quality. And if you squint and if you look at the models and turn your head just right, you might be convinced that there's a little bit of an uptick right here. And the BestFit models agree with you. They think there's an uptick. We ran what we call atmospheric retrievals. We were trying to interpret the spectrum using models. And the models came to a conclusion that there's a bimodal solution. There are two answers to this problem. The first answer is that it is a water-rich atmosphere. And when I say water, I mean actually vapor, water vapor. It could be that the atmosphere is 100% water. And that would be explained by this blue model right there. It could also be that this star has star spots. Our sun has star spots. M dwarfs most definitely have star spots. Because the M dwarfs are cooler, there's actually water vapor in those spots. And they can imprint a fake signal onto our spectrum to try to confuse us, to make us think we're seeing water in the planet, but it's actually seeing water in these star spots. And given the wavelengths that we're at, we can't actually differentiate between those two. So we're going to get more telescope time in June of this year at shorter wavelengths, sort of this like 0.6 to 3 micron range, to differentiate between these two scenarios. So we're seeing evidence of maybe water, maybe in the atmosphere, maybe in the star. We're not sure what the answer is. This is where we're at with this planet. Yeah.
Wouldn't taking a spectra not during transit tell you whether there is water in the star spots?
So the question for people online is, if you take a spectrum of the star not during transit, would you be able to tell if there are star spots there? We do have that, and we do that test. And it shows that we can't fit the model unless we inject star spots into it. So that is a point in favor of the star spot model. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, let's look at another exciting planet, a low density super Earth, L9859D. So here it is 1.5 times the size of the Earth, so a little bit larger, but only 410 Kelvin, a little bit cooler. 410 Kelvin is 280-ish Fahrenheit. So it's oven temperature, right? maybe you don't want to cook a roast at 280 degrees, but it's certainly enough for boiling water, right? Water boils at 210 degrees or so. At 100 degrees Celsius, that's what I like to say water boils at. So much easier to remember. Okay. So let's take a look at this particular system. This is really exciting. The authors published two papers last year on this planet. And you can see, you don't have to squint this time to see that the quality of the data is much better. And you can see that it's not really a flat line. It kind of goes up, it kind of goes down, and goes back up again. And so they think that they've detected hydrogen sulfide, that's H2S, and also sulfur dioxide, SO2. There's a few problems with that, though, is that you really have to put in a lot of hydrogen into this planet's atmosphere to make it puffy enough to see this level of variation in the spectrum. This is not an atmosphere like what you'd expect for Earth or for Venus or for Titan. This is an atmosphere more like Jupiter or Saturn or Uranus or Neptune. If this holds to be true, and we're not sure this is true, if it does, this planet is unlike anything we ever expected, because we don't expect the hydrogen to remain around this planet given its current age. So does it have an atmosphere? Maybe, maybe not. We don't know. We're going to have to do some follow-up observations. It's certainly an interesting candidate, but we're not there yet. Yeah.
Is it possible that it may not be a rocky planet at all, and it's just like gas giant like Uranus?
Yeah, it's possible that it's not a rocky exoplanet. We know it's 1.5 times the size of the Earth, but it's very low density. So maybe it's just young enough where it hasn't lost its atmosphere completely. maybe there's a lot of outgassing happening. That's, I don't know. I mean, it's a puzzle. I don't know how you explain this much hydrogen on the planet's atmosphere. Yeah.
Plus, we go eliminate contamination from other planets also in the past.
What kind of contamination are you thinking of? So this, we know there are three planets in this system, planets B, C, and D. This is the third one, outermost. And we know the transit times of each of them. And it would be, we would know if two planets were transiting at the same time and confusing us, because we've seen that before. And so that is the only way where you could have signal from one planet confusing or allowing us to misinterpret the result, if there are two planets transiting at the same time. Does that help answer it? Okay.
I don't know if you're thinking all about the dynamics of this planetary system, but is it still possible to be in chaotic mode where you have a full outer planet that's now moving in?
Right. So the question online about the dynamics of this system, is it possible that it's a more of a chaotic mode where the planets are migrating? It's possible. Yes, if you had a outer gas giant, its, you know, gravitational pull can actually push these planets inward. It's possible. Yep. If they're young enough, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about a third system right here, LHS 1140b. This is one that I alluded to that's in the habitable zone. It's a little bit larger now, 1.7 times the Earth, size of the Earth, which puts it sort of on the boundary of, is it rocky or is it not? It could be a super Earth or it could be a sub-Neptune. And we really didn't know with these observations going in whether or not it would be a rocky planet. And it's 230 Kelvin, which makes it about minus 40 Fahrenheit, so quite frigid. Here's the transmission spectrum. All right, so let's take this in bits and pieces here. So there's two different concepts. It could be a mini Neptune or a water world. The mini Neptune models are shown sort of in orange and red there, and they're definitely ruled out by the black data points. So we can say confidently that this is not a mini Neptune. And it's probably more likely to be some sort of water world based off of the data, but you can see the features of like an Earth-like spectrum in black or a 5-bar carbon dioxide atmosphere in blue there, they're very, very small. So the observations they had were enough to rule out one scenario. So we think this planet is definitely rocky, but we can't say anything meaningful about its atmosphere. Is that nitrogen dominated or carbon dioxide dominated? We just don't have the precision yet, but we will, because we just got a bunch of telescope time to answer that question. And this is another spectrum of the same planet, just at different wavelengths, just longer wavelengths. And it's basically telling us the same story. There's a lot of scatter here. We're not really sure what's going on, but it's a rocky planet and it probably has a secondary atmosphere, but we don't know what it's made out of.
You'd be using near spec?
We're using both NIRIS and NIRSPEC, so we'll get the full 1 to 5 microns of all these planets.
Okay, so what's the the big blue?
The model? Yeah. Okay, so each of these are realizations of a model. It's essentially a similar model with a slightly different temperature, slightly different abundance of water or carbon dioxide. And they've decided to just throw them all on here to give you the impression that there's something there when there isn't. if I had this plot with just these data points and not the curves, I think you would have all looked at it and say, it's probably flat. I don't see anything. But just between you and me and the recording online, there really isn't any evidence of a nitrogen-rich atmosphere with water and carbon dioxide, as they suggest in the paper. Okay, how are we doing on time here? 8:30. All right, I'm going to skip through this slide, but don't worry about it. It's all good.
because I want to show you a family portrait of all of the transiting exoplanets to date. And I had to put everything on the same scale just so you could understand what was going on. So I'm not showing transit depth as a, like a percent. I just changed to a different unit called scale height. Don't worry about what that means. It's fine. This is the Earth spectrum that I showed you at the beginning of the talk here. Okay, I just cut it off from 1 to 5 microns, but it's the same spectrum. I promise you that. Okay, and that spectrum is right down there. In fact, this is kind of difficult to see. So I'm going to do something different here and zoom in a little bit. This will be easier to see. Okay. What I'm showing you here is this gray line is those, that's the size of that carbon dioxide feature that I showed you in Earth's atmosphere. That's 5 scale heights. Okay. If we wanted to find a planet like the Earth that had a nitrogen-rich atmosphere with some carbon dioxide in it that didn't have much clouds, we would need to have the precision to differentiate at this level. And you can see that the error bars and the scatter in the spectra that we have here are much larger than that, those gray bars that I'm showing you. So the reason why we haven't found any atmospheres is because we just don't have the precision to do it yet. We picked the low-hanging fruit, put it that way. It was very early days for the James Webb Space Telescope, and we looked at hot planets that are less likely to have atmospheres because they're easier to study. They require less telescope time. We didn't get the precision that we need to detect a nitrogen-rich atmosphere because it's easier to detect a water-rich atmosphere or a methane-rich atmosphere or even a hydrogen-rich atmosphere. So we've been slowly sort of crossing things off the list over these past 4 years, saying, okay, as it turns out, these really hot exoplanets probably don't have atmospheres. And you know what? They're probably not 100% water. They're probably not 100% methane. They're definitely not 100% hydrogen. So now we have to take the next steps. We have to go towards cooler planets, and we have to get higher precision. Because this right down here, that's our goal. This is that spectrum that I was showing you at the beginning of the Earth. And we're definitely not there yet. Here's a spectrum of TRAPPIST-1H, by the way. And L9859D, that's the spectrum I showed you there with the SO2 feature, and then LHS-1140. So we're not there yet. We shouldn't be disheartened that we haven't found anything in the first four cycles of GWST time, because we're pushing the limits right now, and we'll get there soon. I think we'll have an answer in the next few years.
We'll get there by looking at cooler.
Looking at cooler exoplanets and using more transit observations to get a higher precision, because this is what we can do. As we build up the number of transits, where it's actually stacking the information and it gets more and more precise.
Would there be any conditions that will be able to accelerate that?
Yes, we'll get there. Yes. Any other questions? Yeah.
Yeah, I heard that red dwarf planets, M stars,
yep,
were really bad candidates for finding life for two reasons. One is the flares that we're talking about. And the other one that I would recall was that the planets tend to be real close and would tend to be tidally locked.
Yeah.
And I think a third one would be, but correct me if I'm wrong, since they're really, really old, they were formed a long time ago when there really wasn't as many cycles of building up elements,
mm-hmm.
so they tend to be devoid of the higher metals, as they call them.
All right, so let's take those one at a time. So the first one has to do with flares, and that sets the cosmic shoreline. That if you have more flares, if you're close into your host star, you have lots of flares, your atmosphere is going to essentially just boil off, right? And so
This is we've done the calculations. We've determined the XUV flux and the likely duration at which the planet's going to experience that high XUV radiation. And we think that, yes, in fact, if you go to earlier M dwarfs, early to mid M dwarfs, it's going to be easier for them to have an atmosphere. And if you're further out, it's going to be easier to maintain that atmosphere. So there is hope. We're worried, but we're not too worried. There is hope. The second point is about tidal locking. There was a couple of early papers that said you couldn't maintain an atmosphere when the planet was tidally locked. A tidally locked planet means it's basically the same face always stares at the sun. Permanent day, permanent night side. Subsequent models that were more complex have shown that that's not the case. Tidal locking is not an issue. So we're good there. And then the third issue is about M dwarfs being old and whether or not you'd have the constituents to actually produce these rocky exoplanets. Yes, we can. It's hard to produce Jupiter-sized planets early on in the universe's lifetime, but it actually turns out to be pretty easy to produce rocky exoplanets. So that's also not a concern. Yeah. Okay, let's for the last we'll call it 5 minutes if you guys can bear with me for a sec, then we'll wrap things up. Yeah.
If I understood you correctly, depending on your spectra by maybe the duration of the transit or the duration of ingress and egress, not by subtracting the spectrums during transit from the spectrum not during transit?
What we're doing is we're measuring the depth as a function of wavelength. So the planet will appear larger or smaller at different wavelengths, and that each of those data points is a depth, is an area ratio of the planet to the star, and that's all we're doing. Simple as that.
Yeah, but you're not subtracting one spectrum from another.
We are not. No. We could, and that's a whole other presentation. And it's a fascinating avenue of discovery that I'd love to have to talk to you about, because I think it's a whole new ball game when you start doing spectrum subtraction.
Yeah, I know that has been used to get some idea of atmospheres and exoplanets.
Yes, I actually developed a technique called planetary infrared excess that does just that. But I will. That's a talk for another time. Okay, looking towards the future and the last couple of minutes here, let's say we use James Webb in the next 5 years and we find all of these rocky exoplanets and they have atmospheres and everyone's excited. What are the next steps? Well, we have to answer the question, is the planet habitable, right? So what do we need in order to support life? It's actually pretty straightforward. There's really only three ingredients. You need an energy source, like the sun or a star, no problem. You need some essential elements for biochemistry, carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, sulfide, those sort of things. Again, very abundant, no big deal. Liquid water, that's kind of tricky, actually. The first two, no big deal. But the third one, we have to look for liquid water on the surface, and that means the Goldilocks zone, the habitable zone, right? So we've been studying a lot of these planets that are too hot because they're easier to study. They have short orbital periods. They have big signal sizes, right? We've also studied a few that are too cold. They're going to have, frozen water. So we have to look at the just right part of the habitable zone and pick out the planets, the dozen or so exoplanets we've discovered, and focus in on those ones. And that'll hopefully tell us whether or not they have life. But just because a planet's in the habitable zone doesn't mean it's inhabited or that even has an atmosphere. So this is the habitable zone of our own solar system, and Earth, thankfully, is in the habitable zone. Hooray. But Mars is as well. But we know Mars doesn't really have an atmosphere. It's not habitable. There's no liquid water. Even though it's in the habitable zone, it just happens to be too small. It wasn't able to retain its atmosphere for long enough. Maybe on the early days of Mars, it had oceans of water. It had an atmosphere, but it lost it all. So just keep that in mind while we look for these potentially habitable planets. And then, of course, the last question, does this planet have signs of life? There's basically, this is talking about the future of future missions. So right now with the James Webb Space Telescope, that is our best shot of looking for life, answering that question this decade. Okay, and we're going to be looking exclusively at these rocky planets around M dwarf stars. That's the best and only place we can look at for that with James Webb. But there is a path forward, and that is the Habitable Worlds Observatory. So this uses a completely different technique called direct imaging, where we don't actually, see the light cross in front of the planet crosses from the star. We use a coronagraph to mask the light from the star to pull out the reflected light of the planet. And this will allow us to actually look at Earth-like planets around Sun-like stars for the first time and search for biosignatures that way. And this is a mission that we can hope, if we have funding, to launch in the 2040s. As long as NASA still exists and the mission is still there, it's a highly sort of complementary technique to the James Webb Space Telescope. And together, it'll help to answer the question of, are we alone? So that's, I think, all the time we have. Thank you very much for coming. I appreciate it. I'll take your questions.
We have time for a few questions.
I sure do.
Thanks for answering those questions during the talk.
It's better that way, I think. It just helps avoid confusion. Yeah.
I understand why you're using M dwarfs. It's hard to know. But is that again another bias? We're around a G spot type star.
Yep.
Okay. Does that let you think that will alter the planetary composition?
So M dwarf stars, their light is different, right? They emit more in the infrared than the optical. I would imagine that life on a planet around an M dwarf star is going to be different if it exists. They'll have different conditions to deal with. There's a whole slew of questions about, how life survives on a planet around an M dwarf star that's tidally locked too, right? And will we recognize it? I don't know. That's a good question. The only data point we have is our own Earth, right? And we're very biased based off of that. And so looking for life on a rocky planet around an M dwarf that may not look anything like us is going to be really challenging. And we might miss it because of that, because we don't know. How do we know the mass of an exoplanet? That's a great question. We use a different technique called the radial velocity technique. Essentially what it does is it measures the wobble of the star itself. There's a gravitational pull between the planet and the star, and they'll kind of move around a common sort of center of gravity. And so even though you don't see the planet, you can see the star wobbling around. And based off of that, you can calculate the mass of the planet. Great question. Yeah.
I was wondering how far out can we go to look for planets, and potentially how many can we see if we can get an estimate? Is there some limit in distance?
Do you care about the size of the planet? Does it have to be rocky? Can it be a Jupiter-sized planet?
I guess maybe habitable.
Okay, yes. So, okay, we can...
Just following up.
Yeah.
From there, could we get some statistics about composition, better statistics for habitability?
Yes, okay. So it's really easy, not really easy. it's easier to detect a Jupiter-sized planet that's transiting. And we can do that out to many... 1,000 light years easily, right? Roman Space Telescope, which you'll hear about next month, They suggest that they may be able to find something like, 10,000 transiting planets, just by staring at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. So that lots of statistics there. For rocky exoplanets, that signal size, that 0.01% transit depth of a rocky planet around sun-like star makes it really tough. So you're limited more or less to M dwarf stars. And because M dwarfs are very faint, you're limited to those that are nearby. So something within probably 100 light years is probably your limit. And from that, we do know of a couple hundred rocky M dwarf planets that are transiting. And for every transiting rocky M dwarf planet, there's probably 50 non-transiting ones that we could detect with the radial velocity technique. So statistically, yes, there are a large number of planets out there that we could potentially study. And what we want to do are those statistics, right? Not just mass and radius. Those are kind of the easy things to do. But once we actually start measuring their atmospheres, figuring out how many are nitrogen-rich atmospheres, how many are carbon-rich or water-rich or some other sulfur-rich atmospheres. I think that's going to be the real exciting sort of exoplanetology studies of the next decade.
Right. With the current imaging techniques, how far out can you go to actually get a spectral, a spectrum of an atmosphere? Are we talking about 1,000 light years, 10,000? I mean, what's the order of magnitude?
We can go out to several hundred light years and get a spectrum of a
Okay.
Jupiter-sized
So
planet. Yeah.
now there's a lot of stars there, but that's not but that's not even a big chunk of the Milky Way. It's
No,
just
not at all. It's the local neighborhood, if you will. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, there are we're just barely scratching the surface in terms of the planets that are accessible to us in the galaxy or in the Milky Way. Yeah.
Okay. Of course, they're all so far away that there's no way of ever reaching
Yes, not unless you have a good imagination.
them.
Yes.
Estimated one?
Is it, sorry?
A spaceship estimated one?
A spaceship. Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. You can get anywhere in an imaginary spaceship, right? Yeah, at the back.
Spectrum. The agency that is the agency that would handle that, the one that was just dissolved this week?
No, NASA or any of its affiliated agencies haven't been dissolved as of.
There was a climate, and the climate, something or other, climate.
No, like NOAA,
Yeah,
it still
it
exists.
still exists. Yes, that's all I'm going to say. As of the moment, everything is funded through this year at NASA. There have been a couple of departments in headquarters that were shut down, impacting a few dozen people, some of which I know. But that doesn't mean we're safe in the future. And I think there's a lot of amazing science that's happening at NASA, especially over the last 25 years. All of those discoveries have been scientific related. And it would be a real shame if we lost 40% of our budget, for no reason, really.
Can you tell them for any
I'm
questions?
looking for questions online. Elizabeth, please repeat for questions. Sorry, I hope I did my best repeating. I may have not repeated all of them.
Yes, okay.
Okay. Are there any questions online? Elizabeth, if you see people raising their hands, please feel free to call on them.
Absolutely.
Thank you. All right. In the meantime, I will answer any more questions. Yeah, go ahead.
We talked about how embers prefer because of their low amount of light makes it much easier to detect
The small size.
massive. Does that mean that are we going to eventually have to approach the detection capabilities that we can now detect these masses from large stars? Then the stars that are full of life, like blue stars, we can have much more recent materials they made to make their planetary bodies on it.
Okay, so the question for people online relates to going from M dwarf stars to larger stars, and studying the planets around these kind of like OBA type stars or maybe the FGK type stars, not as small as M dwarfs. So once you get to the larger stars, the transit technique really falls apart in terms of its usefulness. If you take, for example, the Earth, which is around a G-type star, we're in the habitable zone, and we have an orbital period of 365 days, right? That means there's only going to be one transit every 365 days for aliens to study us, right? And the transit probability is very low. So it's actually a very inefficient technique for studying rocky planets around sun-like stars. This is where the direct imaging solution comes in, where you use like Habitable Worlds Observatory that I was talking about. We'll use that coronagraph to block the sunlight and look at rocky exoplanets around sun-like stars. And that also works for the hotter stars, the F-type stars, O-type stars. The problem with that is if you go to the hottest stars, their life cycles are so short. They don't last for billions of years like our sun. They last for tens or hundreds of millions of years. And that's not really enough time for life to form. So there is a sweet spot, right? If you go to too hot of star, you don't give yourself enough time. So we think the FGK stars are the best spot for the coronagraph.
Operation of that question. How well do you have to know the transit times in order to propose an observation?
How well do you have to know the transit times to propose the observations? You have to know it down to probably within 5 or 10 minutes. Probably 30 minutes is the maximum I'd want to do. The advantage is that we have telescopes like TESS, we have ground-based telescopes, we have amateur astronomers who are setting up their telescopes in their backyard and looking at these transits and recording the time of the transit, and they're actually submitting this information online to the databases in order for us to continue tracking it. Because if we don't know when the transit happens, then we could miss it. And that's it would be a huge shame, not just because we'd miss the transit, but because it's a waste of important resource, like the telescope. Yeah.
Yes. So I remember you were talking about stacking spectra in order to improve the data.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, you know, the orbits of these planets, obviously they have inclinations and whatnot, meaning that sometimes the transit will be at different places on the star's surface, meaning the transit as a whole will be sometimes shorter or longer at times, correct?
Okay. Very few planets change their inclination over the time scales that we can observe. That doesn't mean that some don't, but most planets tend to have the same transit duration.
So that means that you can reliably stack the data and usually it'll fit and work.
Yes, we can reliably stack the data between multiple visits and the math should come out. Hopefully about right.
Thank you.
Okay.
Again.
Yep.
Is there another question? Okay, go ahead.
So let's say we have a tightly locked planet.
Yeah.
You're going to have the large scale wind system. You have hot gases coming down and sinking back down.
Yep.
How much harder is it difficult to determine the composition of the cold gas?
All right. This is a great question. Let's talk about this offline because it's complicated, but stay right there. All right. And maybe we'll wrap it up and then I'll hang around for a bit if you guys have more questions.
More questions? I want to thank you very much for coming. This is fascinating stuff. And it should all be on the lookout for future discoveries.
And unfortunately, as you know, it is raining and nasty outside, so there is no observing. Thank you all very much for coming.
And thank you online for coming.
Thank you very much.